Thank you, Andy, and thank you all for being here. The lost causes, you can add to that. I'm an Australian cricket fan. I love cricket. I just couldn't go far enough to support England. Although I do actually like the English cricket team. Not so much the English football team. But at least there's one lost cause that I don't support. That's FIEC. And so you can see where we're going today. No. I am actually enormously grateful for what is going on here. I'm going to try and explain something that I hope I can explain. I'm not sure I can. I was lying awake last night thinking about it. I am a Scottish Calvinist. There's a guy wrote a book called The Wee Book of Calvin, who's an atheist, and it's like Calvinism without Christ. Calvinism without Christ probably has to be the worst religion in the world. It's just awful. And this guy's from Aberdeenshire, and he has this image of dour, grey, miserable. And so, you know, the thing is, there's sunshine today. Aye, but there's rain coming. You know. We had a really good service today. I will pay for it tomorrow. You know, and partly it's a caricature because partly it's true. We're always in spiritual warfare. And actually the devil gets you often when you're at your highest. You come back Sunday evening, it's brilliant, and you're just as high as a kite, and then wham, he hits you with something, you know. And that does often happen. But I like to think in things or in terms of big picture and, you know, where we're at in terms of evangelism. And I really do think that it's still very hard for Christians to be honest and Christian leaders to be honest about where our churches are at and where our country's at. And I remember I offered I shouldn't do this. I thought out loud one time and wrote out loud. And I do have this blog, which one of my friends said, oh no, that's like giving a pyromaniac a fire thrower, you know. And I wrote an analysis of the Church of Scotland, not because I wanted to hammer the Church of Scotland, but because the Church of Scotland for me was very important, and I wanted to, for the gospel, and I got such a hammering from evangelicals for being so negative and pessimistic. My only regret about that particular article is that I kept back some of the stuff, because everything I wrote has happened, but worse. And people go, oh, if only we'd known. Actually, if we'd opened our eyes, we should have seen. And so we need to open our eyes. We need to be absolutely realistic. But you can only do that. You'll crack up if you do that. But you can only do it if you keep your eyes fixed on Christ. So I'm in McShane's pulpit, Murray McShane's, for every look at self, take 10 looks at Christ. So for every look at the culture, take 10 looks at Christ. I love Dick Lucas. And one time I was at a conference, and Dick Lucas afterwards, you know, he said, I'm 80 plus, I can say what I want now. And I thought, I think you always did. But and I said, you know, how did you enjoy it? Dear boy, if I hear another word about culture, I'm going to scream. You know? And, you know, I kind of understood where he was coming from. We can ever analyzing, but never able to come to the practice of the truth. But I do think it's helpful for us to see where we are. And for me, our culture has been rapidly disintegrating. Sadly, Scotland more than anywhere else in the UK, even Yorkshire, you know. And we're moving towards this fundamentalist, secularist, militant society where Christianity is, for many people, both irrelevant and also the enemy. By the way, in our culture, don't expect logical consistency. Logic's gone out the way. It doesn't work for the way that it is. In our culture, in my view, the people at the top are the most militantly atheistic and secularist, which I find it interesting that there's a view in Christian circles that in order to reach everybody, it's trickle-down theory. Get the people at the top. Go to Oxford, Cambridge. Get all them, and then you'll get the poor. And the answer is no, you probably won't. And I don't think that's the methodology of the New Testament. I think it's quite dangerous. I think my view is we go for everybody. And if God saves the Nicodemuses and the tax collectors, like Matthew's probably fairly wealthy of this world, the Corneliuses, that's great. But you know, don't patronize things like 20 schemes and say, well, we've got to reach the poor and we need the middle class and the rich to reach the poor. What if it's the other way around? What if it's the poor who end up being the best evangelists? You know, please don't patronize people who are working in schemes, because the people in the schemes are as human as you and me. And actually, they may be freer to engage in effective evangelism. But anyway, I think our culture's been going this direction. I think it's been incredibly hostile. I used to think we were apathetic until I wrote the Dawkins letters and then the hostility. I get hate mail pretty well every day. You'll see it. Don Carson was telling me that the Gospel Coalition, whenever it engages with something culturally, it's kind of it hits on its website, go up from 8 million to almost double that, but the vitriol and the amount of money they have to spend on security and dealing with hackers. I've had to sit down with people sometimes in my own church and say, what do we do if this starts happening? What do we do if people start coming in and disrupting things? And so there's that hostility, but this, and I've only come to this view this year, and it might be wrong, and I'm only thinking it through, and this is the first time I've said it in public. My view is that the devil has overreached himself. And the particular issue that is causing chaos is gender. And, you know, I was told on BBC Radio Scotland last week, there was a guy came on and said, David Robertson's the only person who opposes this. There's one or two others like him. And I thought, you arrogant so-and-so, you put me up in front of any audience against you and 95% of the people will agree with me. Because I'm going with the Dundee taxi drivers. And they're not politically correct at all. And you know, and it's really, really interesting where that's coming from. But I've noticed just changes. For example, let me give you just one or two changes that I think have occurred. Some of the biggest allies we've got at the moment in terms of assessing the culture and where it's at are gay atheists, like Douglas Murray, or a liberal. He's not a Christian. Please don't say Jordan Peterson's a Christian. He's not a Christian. But someone like Jordan Peterson, and let me give you just one example of that. I used to be on the Scottish Secular Society webpage and stuff, and until I just got tired of all the abuse. But the vice president at one point wrote me, and he'd written some pretty vitriolic stuff. And about a year ago, he wrote me and he said, David, I'm still an atheist. I'm still not a Christian. But your analysis of culture, I now accept. There's this guy called Jordan Peterson, and I smiled. And he says, he's speaking the truth. They had 1,500 mostly young men in Glasgow paying a fortune to go and hear a guy teach about morality and responsibility. And I'm thinking, you're so close. If only you had the gospel. You know, but how come Jordan Peterson is reaching a lot of these guys? And so I think that's one. Another is Jordan Peterson, okay. Well, Jordan Peterson's Welsh. No. No. He's from the valleys. Jordan Peterson is a Canadian psychologist who became famous because, amongst other things that he did, he would deal with people who were transgender. And in Canada and in his university, they mandated that you must use people's preferred pronouns. And he took a stand saying, no, you don't have a right to forced speech. So his big thing was against enforced speech. And he basically got fired. But this is totally bizarre. He has YouTube videos. And his most popular is a three-hour video discussing the story of Adam and Eve. And millions of people have watched it. So when you say, oh, people just go for sound bites, no, millions of people have watched this stuff. And he decided to take a stand. And he basically said, stuff you lot, I'm just going to do this online. And he wrote a book called 12 Rules for Life, which is okay. I wrote a review of it. It's fine. Sold millions. And the more they tried to ban him, the more popular he became. I mean, it's the number one book in the UK. It was the number one book in Australia, number one book in Europe, number one book in America, and even in his native Canada. And he's been on tour. I mean, he absolutely sold out a big stadium in London. It's a guy standing up and speaking about serious things for 2 hours. You know, you're thinking, wow, Where's this coming from? And I do think Jordan Peterson, so thank you for asking, because for those who didn't know, I think that's quite significant in that degree. I also think another significant thing is I find my biggest allies at the moment are feminists, which is really very funny. But that's the transgender thing. They're known as TERFs, trans-exclusionary radical feminists. So you know the world's gone mad when Jermaine Greer gets banned from universities. You know, you just think, oh, you're kidding me. Even Peter Tatchell got banned. You know, I mean, this is like the revolution eats itself. They have no idea how to do it. And what's happening is people are mass confused. Now, one of the dangers that we can do is we can just make fun of it, which I love, you know. And Christians come and say, oh, I don't think, I think what you said about Richard Dawkins wasn't very nice. So to which my response is always, you should be so thankful for what I didn't say. And that I'm not Martin Luther, you know, and various other things. But you can. I think you can gently rib and mock and all that kind of stuff. But let me tell you this. The people who suffered the most because of late 1960s, hippie, free love and stuff, weren't the wealthy. Upper middle class people are 80 to 85% more likely to be married in stable relationships, although they'll teach the opposite. It's the poor. It's 40% married, and that's with the kids. I mean, I do a club with kids. 19 out of the 20, you can't say go home to your mum and dad. And there's one boy, I said to him one time, he just said, look, I need to talk to your dad about this. And he said, which one? I said, okay, what do you mean which one? He says, my Monday dad, my Tuesday dad, my Wednesday dad, my Thursday dad, and my Friday dad. Mum had a different guy to stay over. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Those kids have no chance. No chance. I know they're going to jail. You know, and that's, by the way, where we need a passion in terms of education, not about protecting particularly our children. But we should have a passion for education, for protecting everybody, for teaching people the truth. So I think, but what I'm trying to say in terms of the change that I think is occurring is our world is dark and confused, and there the light shines brighter. Two stories about that. A woman called Anna Sutherland, missionary with Christian Witness to Israel, came from the village of Brora up in the Scottish Highlands, where I went to be a minister. And if you're from the southeast, you think it's Brigadoon, you want to go up and buy a hotel, it's a little paradise, Scottish Highlands, community of 2,060 registered alcoholics. It's the only place I've been where my manse was firebombed. You know, I don't, you know, all people who've got this idea, oh, you live in an inner city, that's really rough, and then you live in rural ways, what a paradise, Wales, what a paradise it is. No, it's not. Sin's the same everywhere. And it expresses itself in different ways. So, I remember Anna coming and I was saying, this is a tough gig, this one. And she said, yeah. And then she just quoted me Romans. She said, where sin abounds, grace superabounds. That's your motto. Thomas Guthrie, the founder of the Ragged Schools movement in the 19th century in Scotland, had finished his seminary education, was standing looking over the grass market in Edinburgh, which is now posh Yuppieville. You know, that's what happens. They kind of go up, you know, but at that time, he looked over and 50% of the children died before they reached five. People live sometimes 20 to two rooms. It stank, no hygiene. Cholera, loads of disease, drunkenness, prostitution, everything. And he's standing as the stench comes up to him from the bridges in Edinburgh, which is now so romantic and so on. And he was so, he thought, what do I do? He'd just been appointed. He thought, what do I do? What do I do? And Thomas Chalmers came up, put his arm around him, and with his other hand gestured over the whole grass market and said, a fine field, young man, a fine field. And I think that's the attitude we need to have. I grew up in a Brethren context. I'm very thankful for it. I think the Brethren, one of the great things about the Brethren was the love for the Word of God. But one of the worst things was the defeatist mentality. We're the remnant of the remnant of the remnant. And they're on the wrong lifeboat. Their lifeboat's too big. Let's make ours smaller, you know. you know, in an ideal world, let's make sure there's no women, you know, but I say, and half my elders agree with this, that we belong to the biggest church in the world, ex-Brethren. But But there's many, many good things, as I say, in the brethren. But this defeatist mentality. See, you might go the opposite way. Like my good friend Paul Rees here is utterly shocked when he discovered, I did a program with some people in America, that he discovered, they asked me, are you a post-millennialist? And I said, yes. And I just thought every biblical Christian was a put. No. And I'm trying to work out how many divisions I can bring into this room within 45 minutes. But what I meant by post-millennialism, I've just always believed that the gospel will prosper. And I believe that there will come a time when someone won't need to say to their neighbor, know the Lord, because all will know them. You know, I believe that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. I really do. And so I can't say when, I can't say how, I can't. So I'm an optimist in that way. Whereas the brethren mentality was the ship's going down, let's get in our lifeboats, cover it up, and wait till Jesus returns. Because he's going to come very, very, very soon. Well, he might or he might not. I don't know. You know, I think that the temptation to circle the wagons is a mistake. And here's why. And I'm sorry, I'm going back to the brethren again, the Taylorite brethren, the purest of the pure. I had relatives who were in them. But Taylor was eventually convicted, rightly so, of severe sexual abuse. You know, and we need to be very, very, very careful. We can be too broad and inverted commas liberal, which to me is non-Christian, or we can be too inward-looking and defeatist. And I think there's a balance. Now, in terms of our culture, how does that tie in with where we're at? In terms of our culture, I think the devil's overreached himself. I think there's great darkness and there's great confusion. And I think if you bear a steady, open, public witness demonstrated by your church in the love that you have for one another and in the clear proclamation of the gospel, this is an ideal time to be spreading the gospel in Britain. We are not a progressive society. We are regressing to a Greco-Roman pagan view of the world. But it's in that Greco-Roman pagan world that the gospel first flourished. So we have to avoid worldliness and worldly methodology, but we have to engage with the world that we are in. And that means, you know, the Bible gives us permission to use a huge variety of different things. But for me, the greatest thing is confidence. What do you do? There's seven people in a church. You go, four of them leave. The handful that are left, one or two that start coming in. What do they need? You know what they need? They need confidence that the gospel actually works. Today, here, now, in this place. If you can give your congregations confidence in the gospel, you will not have to worry about how you do evangelism. I think most of us are in situations where our people, and maybe even us, we've lost confidence in the gospel. Now, a couple of times in my life, one not so long ago, I lost confidence. I don't think I lost confidence in the gospel, but I certainly lost confidence in myself, and not in a good way. And I lost confidence in the church. I lost confidence in a lot of different things. But to know that the gospel works, to know that you've got gold or you've got this fantastic feast that you're giving to people, to really know it, to feel it, is hugely, hugely important. And I think in our culture, we need that clarity. To me, the church in Scotland is dying. I'm not going to make a comment about anywhere else, though I think it's probably not that different in the rest of the UK. Civic Christianity will continue for a while with establishment churches and people saying they can be chaplains in schools and, you know, we're here to bless the whole and everything, and they will continue to die. But churches which preach and live the gospel without being tied and confined to a particular tradition will flourish. Because people come in. I remember Gordon Wilson, the former leader of the Scottish National Party, came into our church, and he had a big influence on my life. He died last year, and he became a member in the church. And he just gave me this huge row. He said, David, how come I've lived in Scotland all my life? I've never heard this. This is a great message, he says. And, you know, he got it. He absolutely did get it. And I think that our responsibility is to get this message out. And the culture within where at the moment is there are people who are hungry for it. Of course, there are people who are opposed. Of course, there are people who will be angry. Of course, there are people who won't get it. But I just think the devil has overreached himself. And we have so many opportunities that the problem for me is, which ones do we take? not how do we find a way. So let me, having said that, that's all, let me just say this. Our evangelism is largely stage one, not stage five evangelism. What does that mean? Stage zero, if you like, or stage one, is where people, you come into the church and you say, now we're going to look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. That's on page 1 of the Bible, which is the book in front of you. So they don't know. They just know nothing. Stage 10 is when, oh yeah, the Westminster Shorter Catechism, that was, I learned that when I was 3. You know, I've done the larger and I've got my Bible here in Serbo-Croat and Greek, you know, and Don Carson, too simple for me, you know. Right, so that's stage 10. Most of us don't have stage 10 people, but most of our evangelism is geared at stage 5. So for example, asking people to believe in Jesus, it's utterly meaningless if they don't know who Jesus is. Because they just have their own personal Jesus. They have their own image. So you have to tell them about Jesus first before they can believe in him. Saying to people, just have faith or to repent of your sin or whatever it is, it's utterly meaningless. And I think most of our evangelism is actually at that stage. Often, even amongst our own people, I'm amazed at how many people I meet who've grown up in the free church who don't know what the gospel is. And yet they've been preached it. So, you know, the stage one evangelism, one of the things about it for me is you have to be really, really patient. It's not like in Whitfield's day. Or this is not Haringey in the 1950s or Kelvin Hall in the 1950s, where thousands of people who were going to church and knew the basic background heard the gospel and largely understood the language. Now we are speaking a foreign language, and we have to learn how to translate that. And that's, again, I mean, I was really pleased that there was a good attendance at the 20 Scheme stuff and things like that last night. You say, oh, it's really hard in a working class community. No, I think it's harder in other communities in some ways. Because so many people think they know. They don't know. We're in a post-Christian society. We're not in a pre-Christian society. And the trouble with a post-Christian society is people think they know what Christianity is, but they don't. So I think that's it. There are a whole bunch of what Tim Keller calls defeater beliefs. The very reasons that people won't even come, you know, I can't go to church because you're homophobic, can't go to church because science has disproved everything, you know, these kind of things. And I do think in your preaching, you have to deal with those without making every sermon a lecture. My view is that the Bible deals with these, but you need to be aware of the issues that are involved. And you need to teach your own people in such a way that they themselves absorb it and then translate it. So, you know, we have a guy who was converted from a Roman Catholic background, and I did love, his conversion was amazing because he wouldn't come to church because we were a Protestant church, but a prayer meeting was okay. So he came to the prayer meeting. The second prayer meeting was that he went, I just heard him pray. He prayed out loud, Father, I thank you for my new family, for my new faith. I thank you for Jesus. And I stopped the prayer meeting and said, oh, and what's up with you? You've been converted. Aye, I think so. I'm going, oh, and this is a Presbyterian church. That doesn't happen. Don't start praying, you know, just take your time, boy, you know. But he was converted, and classic, you know, what do you do? His partner is not a Christian. Furious at him coming to the church and changing. Do I leave my partner? Well, no, Owen, you've got 2 kids. But isn't that living in sin? No. It would be more sin to abandon your kids. I mean, these are complex situations that happened in the New Testament. That's why an elder should be the husband of but one wife. Why an elder? Why not everybody? Because there's a situation that they were dealing with, and we have that situation. So I smiled with Owen, you know, with the defeater beliefs and all the kind of things that he had. He came to help us in the manse one time. We were painting. I'm useless. I'm absolutely useless at everything. And he was painting the bedroom walls, and I said, Owen, thank you so much for coming to help. And he says, oh, no, Davey, you're the man that gave me the Holy Spirit, so after I owe you big time. I said, Owen, see, next time in church, can you stand up and say that so all my charismatics. Now the reason I mention Owen is this. My son's doing a church plant in the poorest area in Dundee just now, and Owen's from that area. And Owen comes and he hears the word from me, but Owen translates it into the language and people of his culture and context. And that's what we want. We want, you know, to train our people, to educate. And we have to educate ourselves to do that. Our faith is reasonable. Lloyd-Jones described preaching as God reaching the heart through the head. I think evangelicalism overall has fallen into the trap of trying to reach the head through the heart. Let's get people to feel this. Well, you can, and if you can, it's manipulation. It's up to the Holy Spirit to do that, but it is through the head. However, the opposite extreme of that is often in reform circles where it's like everything's academic. I'm sorry, but the penal substitutionary atonement of Christ is not a subject for an academic lecture. It's a subject for praise. And that doesn't say you don't use your mind. Of course you use your mind. You go deep, 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 deep. But don't, you know, I mean, one, don't patronize people, but our faith is the most reasonable position. I mean, I find, and it's not because I'm particularly brilliant. I'm not. I think quickly on my feet and I can speak. But I cannot recall ever having lost a debate in the past 10, 15 years with atheists and secularists and other people. Why? Because their position is fundamentally inconsistent. Even Richard Dawkins, you say to him, well, you must be a social Darwinianist. Oh, no. I'll give you another example. A brilliant chemist came to the church and mum was a member with us and been converted. She's postdoc. And I said to her, do you really seriously believe that everything is chemical? She said, yes. I said, well, even love, even... She said, yes. I said, do you live like that? She said, no. I said, okay. I have a worldview and a philosophy that I live by. You're inconsistent. I don't know a consistent atheist. I really don't. Dawkins tries, but he's not. So I think our faith is very, very reasonable. I think one of the things you're showing to people is, actually, this makes sense. You know, it just makes sense. It works. I mean, people expect us to be weird, and they expect us to be unreasonable. Bizarrely, in a society which has lost its grip on logic and sanity and reason, our way to reach them is not to become like them. Our way to reach them is to show what sanity and reason is. And so many people appreciate that. We've got the best product in the postmodern marketplace of ideas. Total apologetics, the whole gospel to the whole person by the whole church. I do think it takes the whole church to evangelize. And you do have to try and build that into your church. I just give one example of a very small thing, and I'm going to use Paul again since I slagged him off earlier. I love Charlotte Chapel and what they're doing, but the thing that made me realize they're an alive church. I think you recognize you're a live church if there's a spontaneous creativity as well. And there's a computer game, Red Dead Redemption or whatever, and one of Paul's guys saw the poster outside advertising this and just drew a mock-up about real redemption. And this is the way our world is. The Sun newspaper, it went viral, and the Sun newspaper got hold of it and ran an article on redemption being preached at Charlotte Chapel. It's brilliant. You just can't, you know, who knows what God will use. But we've got a consistent, we're not using gimmicks. We've just got a consistent gospel that gives us freedom to reach out to people. What can we do? I'm saying there's a new atheism. I'm just going to just mention a couple of things that I've done. The new atheism, I still think the new atheism is very strong. By the way, although technically only about 20% of people are atheists, the last survey had 54% of people in the United Kingdom saying they weren't religious. I just saw that the latest HMS London is taking, it always had, you know, God guide us, in Latin, which I'm sure you all know, Domine, whatever it is. But the latest one is just taking God out of it. And it's just going to have as its motto, guide us. To which I want to go, who's doing the guiding? You know, how stupid do you have to be to take God out of the motto, God guide us? Who are you asking? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But that's, I'm sorry, this is a bizarre world in which our elites live, I think. And most normal people recognize that. You know, like, let Glasgow flourish by the preaching of the word was the motto of Glasgow. So in its genius, Glasgow City Council decides to make it let Glasgow flourish. Well, what does that mean? And how? Let Glasgow flourish by the preaching of the word. So I think that, but what I think about the new atheism is there's a bunch of more militant atheists, But my belief is that between 80 and 85% of people in the United Kingdom are functional atheists, including many people in your church. Why? Because they live as if there were no God. They may pay lip service to various forms of religion, but they live as if there was no God. I heard something once, I can't remember who it was from, but it did stick with me, and it was this: if you took the Holy Spirit out of the church in the United Kingdom today, we'd carry on 90% as if nothing had happened. So we need to be really, really careful in all of that. I was really intrigued reading John Owen, John Flavel, and so on, how often they refer to atheism. But didn't everyone believe in God then? Yeah, but they were talking about real atheism, not theoretical atheism. People who use God but don't. So I think that's a key thing. I got involved in a kind of apologetic type stuff with the Da Vinci Code. Local Church of Scotland came and said, can we do something with the Da Vinci Code with you? And I said, yeah, our two churches work together. I said, let's do it in a neutral venue. Let's go to Dundee Contemporary Arts, which we did. And we asked the people, can we do a debate or a discussion after you've shown the film The Da Vinci Code one time, or do it one night, hire your lecture theater? And they said, no, you don't need to hire it. We'll do the debate, but we'll run it. And we'll charge £3 a ticket. And I said, no, we'll buy the place and just give it to people for free. And they said, David, you need to understand something. Make people buy tickets, then they'll come. And I thought, no way. The first time I'd ever done that in a church was in a charismatic church in Bedford, where they made people pay £5 for a coffee and a chance to hear me, which I just thought was wacko, but it worked. And so I thought, oh, well, fair enough. I said, well, we'll buy all the tickets. They said, no, don't buy all the tickets. Let's sell them at the box office and let's see what happens. So we did. We sold out. And I'll never forget it, because there were 200 people there and 100 of them were non-Christians. This guy comes up to me after and says, David, that was absolutely brilliant. He said, just brilliant. He said, I haven't been to church for 50 years. I'm so glad this was on, because it wasn't organized by a church and you didn't have an agenda. And I said, I've got really bad news for you. It was organized by a church and we do have an agenda. And he says, what church? And I said, oh, St. Peter's and Logan, St. John's Cross up the road. He says, what's your agenda? I said, to get people talking about Jesus. He says, that's not an agenda. See, for him, an agenda meant trying to get people into the church, get their money, do all this kind of things. And I think we need to be careful about that too, how we do things. And so we began going out doing a lot of stuff. I wrote a wee book on, I ended up not writing it. People recorded it and then wrote it, because we were doing so much cafe evangelism. Coffee shops have been a great boon, and the smoking ban has been a great boon. Because even in Dundee in February, people are sitting outside as though it's Milan in spring, you know, smoking and having their coffee. But it's just wide open. You know, there's so many coffee shops, so many opportunities. As I said, I ended up writing the Dawkins letter, which I did write it to engage with non-Christians, because I saw it as an opportunity to reach non-Christians. Really interesting, in the States, one of the Christian publishers told me that most of the books about the Dawkins letters were written for Christians to help Christians defend their faith. I'm sorry, but if my 12-year-old daughter had read The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins and couldn't defeat it, I think I probably would have disowned her. You know, it shows the vacuous state of Christianity that we're so scared by Richard Dawkins, when in actual fact, he gave us a great opportunity. 1 million copies of his book sold in this country, and it's a book about God and the Bible and everything else. We need to take the opportunities, you know. And I'm sorry, it sounds so kind of cliched, but stop seeing threats as just threats. They're also opportunities. And there's great opportunities with that. I'm very thankful for Richard Dawkins, because he's given me so many opportunities to proclaim the gospel to people. I actually know more people who've been converted through Richard Dawkins than who've been deconverted. You know, like the atheist bus slogan, remember that one? There's probably no God. I did a debate with the woman who designed it, and I thanked her for the £250,000 worth of free publicity. I said, every time one of your buses pass, I go, you see that? What do you think of that? And that gets us going, you know. I said, keep going. Have you got another one coming? You know, I said, next time, please don't make it so easy. I mean, how vacuous is that? There's probably no God. So, I mean, imagine, you're a woman whose son has just died. There's probably no God, so go and cheer up. What an empty, vacuous, soppy, middle-class guardian-type slogan. You know, get a grip. And so there are just these opportunities. As I said, Gordon Wilson came in. I've been praying to try and get on the BBC for a long time. It's really, really hard. And the people who kept us out of the BBC were professing Christians, liberals who did not want their domination of the media. I found that more militant atheists sometimes, well, maybe not the militant ones, but a lot of atheists and seculars. Here's the thing about most journalists in Britain, they're ignorant. And I don't mean, I'm not saying this as a derogatory thing, I'm saying they just don't know what Christianity is. So I get a phone call, can you come and appear in a program about alcohol? Yeah, absolutely. And they said, well, great, we're really glad to get you, David, and so on. And then just before I left, I said, by the way, what's your opinion? And I said, well, I think alcohol is blasphemous. He said, oh, good, good. I said, if it's not malt whiskey. If it's malt, if it's blended whiskey, then, you know, if there was a purgatory, you're going to it. And she said, you drink. I said, yes, I've never been drunk in my life. God has preserved me from that. Drunkenness is wrong. But take a little wine for the stomach's sake, the wine that makes glad the heart. And she said, oh, David, I'm sorry you can't come on the program. I said, why not? She said, you're too sensible. I said, you wanted a free church minister with a dog collar to come on and say that people who drink alcohol are going straight to hell. She said, well, yeah, pretty well. And that was the kind of culture we were fighting against. But bit by bit by bit, those barriers are being eroded. And one of the things I want to encourage you as church leaders is find ways to get in your local newspaper because they can't afford to employ journalists and they're desperate for copy. Gordon Wilson, when he came into the church, he said, David, we've got to get this message out. This is ridiculous. This is far more important than Scottish nationalism, which for a leader of the Scottish National Party, you have no idea what that means. You know, that's like a Man United fan saying, I'm not going to the game on Saturday because I want to go to church. You know, or something. And he said, press release, let's do press release. I said, what for? He says, I'll put out a press release every week on behalf of St. Peter's. I thought, this is crazy. I said, but let him do it, you know. The drip, drip, drip effect worked. A few weeks later, I get a phone call from a journalist. David, what's this about two new elders being elected? And I said, okay. elders is how we govern the church. He says, yeah, but why is that a story? And I'm thinking, yeah, why is that a story? And I was thinking, quick, you know, Lord, help me. What do I do? And I said, no, I'll tell you why it's a story. You can get everything to be a story. I said, do you know this? This church was dying. And we had virtually no people coming to it. Now we've got lots of young people, and two of the young men are becoming elders. I think that's a good news story. We had a half-page story in the newspaper, church renewed with young men and so on. You can't buy that kind of publicity. You know, get to know people. Take a journalist for a coffee. If they write trash about something, make sure that the only time you write to the BBC is not just when they do something, you know, on sexual moral issues. Meet up with people. I mean, I'll give you one extreme example. Kaleidoscope is a gay magazine in Scotland, probably the gay magazine. And they wrote a piece. It's just weird. Free Church, when I was a main moderator of the Free Church, Free Church takes lurch to right with appointment of homophobic moderator. You know, now, in Free Church terms, I'm like loony left, you know, and so this was just, it was incredible. So I wrote to the editor and said, look, you can write about me what you want, but if you're going to do a main story, you probably should have interviewed me. And to his credit, he said, yes, David, you're right. Write me 1,000-word piece on what the Bible says about homosexuality and what the church's attitude is. And I did, and it's still way and above their most popular article ever. And he almost got fired for it, because all these people were writing, said, how can you have this homophobe doing? How can you, you know? But what struck me was one of the gay activists wrote in and said, listen, you guys need to back off the editor and you need to back off David Robertson, because I'd rather be in a Scotland where his Christianity was predominant than in any other country in the world. Don't necessarily assume hostility, but don't back down from the word ever. Ever. You know, you have to learn how to deal with the homosexual question because it's the wife-beating question. When did you stop being your wife? You know, you have to learn how to deal with it, but you have to learn how to turn everything so that it's presenting the gospel to people who need Christ. Now, it doesn't say it's going to turn out easy. It's not. But I just think there's great opportunities. Where can I find Jesus? I'm going to come back to that. I just want to mention some. I'm just going to list them because I want to give you a wee bit of time to ask some questions. I think there are 10 target areas of engagement, right? One is society, our mercy ministries and all that kind of stuff. But one big thing is this. The Bible commands us to pray first of all for our politicians. Every member of our congregation should know who their local MP is, local councillors. We should be praying for them. It doesn't matter their politics. It shouldn't be evident, you know. Oh, Lord, we pray for Theresa May. Will you smite the Amalekites? You know, can you get that Jezebel? No, I mean, that, not like that. But we pray. It's a command. It's a command. And I think we should do that. But there are lots and lots of issues where the Christian gospel speaks to the culture and provides something that is alternative and different. Science. We have to get rid of this myth that science and faith are opposed. No, they're not. And I do think you do have to get, you know, like Lennox's book and so on, but most of us will have access to people who are scientists. I mean, when people go to me about science and faith, I say, well, half my congregation are scientists. And they say, really? I said, yeah, well, I've got some science lecturers and science students, but I've got so many medics, and I really, really hope that our doctors are scientists. I don't want them to be faith healers, you know. I want them to know what they're doing. And I just think there's a great opportunity with science. People don't understand what science is. I do think that cafe evangelism, it's just so easy to do, and the smallest church can do it at some level. And I do think there are public forums that we can go to. Music. The atheists ain't got no songs. And they don't. You know, is it, what's his name, the comedian, the American comedian, Steve, what's his name, has a YouTube clip on, he's got, just Google atheists ain't got no songs. It's absolutely hilarious. You know, but they don't have any songs. They don't have any music. They actually don't really have any art either. And there's an apologetic of beauty from Mozart to Metallica, I would call it. You know, I just think that's enormously important. Same with art. Every single community, you know, art doesn't make sense without the artist. I used to do a lecture in all of Scotland's art colleges entitled Can Atheists Be Artists? And they used to get, it was entitled Can Artists Be Atheists? And they used to get really mad because they thought it was, can atheists be artists? So all these atheists would turn up to tell me that they could be. And I said, yes, you can be, but it's inconsistent. It's philosophically incoherent for you to be an artist if you're an atheist. And that was always interesting. Medicine. The medical profession is probably proportionately better represented in all your constituencies, I would suspect, than almost any other profession. Well, why not? And why not take advantage and the opportunities with that exist? Our NHS is in absolute crisis, and it's in crisis because it was founded on Christian principles. It's gone away from the Christian principles. What do you expect? History. I'm a historian. I did my degree in history. History is his story. Sorry for the cliche. There's an apologetic for history. There's not a single person in this room that does not belong to a community which does not have a Christian influence. And you can use that to present the gospel. Media. We need to learn how to use media. Christians in media, I've mentioned local things. We need to be a contact point for the secular media. We need development of high-quality Christian media. Please, never, ever have a church website if you don't update it. I'm horrible going to church websites that have from 2 years ago under construction. Well, don't. You can use social media, you can use Facebook, you can use Twitter and so on. Just be careful how you use it. Learn how to use it. One of the things I did, I just tried loads of things, and some of them haven't worked. Tried a magazine, didn't work so well. I did a podcast, which we've had to take away from Solas, basically because I need the freedom to say things that upset people and organizations don't like the flag. And so I just thought, I'll just take the flag personally. But here's the bizarre thing about this podcast. It's just really weird. There's a guy from the BBC who's volunteered to help produce it. And it goes out every Friday. And it's quite a few of you here who come and say, do you listen to it? All I do is just think about issues during the week, take clips off radio and television, talk about them. The whole thing lasts about 20 minutes. But people are non-Christians are listening to it. And I just think, well, that's just one example. Use them. I mean, if you'd like to, that's the thing for it up there. Philosophy. We need to use philosophy. We are what we think. We need to think, and we need to encourage our people to think. And the church. I'll come back to this. I think the church is so vital and so important. And whether it's renewing churches or planting churches or whatever it is that we're doing, it's the church that bears the witness to Jesus Christ in the community. And maybe I'll finish with going back to this story that I mentioned about Christ. Says he, if I can find it. Where can I find Jesus? Okay. I'm watching a reality TV show. Now, I confess, I don't watch them. But they're like watching car wrecks or train wrecks. You know you shouldn't, but you do. So I was watching this reality TV show, and I kept watching it because it was about a kid from Derby who went to America, to Atlanta. He's gay, 18 years old, alcoholic, drug abuse, swore like a trooper. He goes to Atlanta, and it was kind of like a parent swap program or something. And he's put in a home with a couple of African-American Baptists, pastors, both of them, husband and wife, are both pastor. And, you know, you realize that you've lost touch with reality when the only thing that bothers you is not the drugs, but the fact they're not complementarian. So it was incredible. I mean, it did not go well. There was a clash. Ran away. There was just, and you see, actually, my sympathy largely ended up with the kid more than with the couple. Although I have to say, I was so impressed with that couple by the end. Because they were just genuine, and they did love him, and I thought their theology was a bit messed up with some stuff. But I liked the kid, you know, gay, promiscuous, confused, swearing like a trooper. And then this was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. The end of the program, he's going back to the airport in the taxi. You never ever see the presenter. The presenter obviously is in the front, turns to the back seat. Have you enjoyed this? Oh, just I won't do the Derby accent because I won't offend anyone here from Derby. And I can't anyway, but he says, just these people, this was great, this was brilliant. And then he stopped and he looked and he says, they're really into Jesus, aren't they? They really, really believe in Jesus. And then he stopped and he just kind of looked and he said, see, when I go back to England, where can I find Jesus? Is he in the yellow pages? And I started crying. I was so emotionally affected by that. And you know what, part of me, I wrote a piece, I edited a magazine at that point, and I said to my designer, you're going to do this in the style of the Yellow Pages. And I wrote an article called Where Can I Find Jesus? And my answer was, he could walk into a lot of churches in this country and he wouldn't find Jesus. And God have mercy on those people if he walks to look for Jesus and he doesn't find him in a church. But then my Calvinist side kicked in, and I thought, listen, son, Jesus is going to find you. But how is Jesus going to find him? Because you and you and you and you and you, you're going to go out and seek on behalf of Jesus for his people. I've never forgotten that kid, and I pray for him, and I don't even know his name. And when I hear that the church is here from Derby, I'm thinking, that's why you're there. You're not there to be a successful church. You're there to make sure that a kid who wants to know where he can find Jesus, that there's somewhere we can say, you go there. And you'll find Jesus. You go to that home. You meet these people. And you'll find Jesus. That's what I think evangelism is. Okay. Any questions or comments before we go for lunch? Or catch our planes or whatever it is. Anyone feel free. I think I do. We do have a microphone, don't we? Yeah, we do. So feel free. Anyone want to make any comment or just go home? I don't care. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering if you could, you touched on it real briefly, but maybe I'll steal a term from Dan Strange, speak a little bit about the sticky sentimentality that we have in our culture and how that can affect your evangelism and even church life.
Well, I think you deal with the sticky sentimentality the same way you deal with false reasoning, by real reasoning and real sentimentality. So I'll tell you this. I saw one of our students talking to an elderly lady, and because the lady was a bit deaf, she was on her knees, just holding her hand. And I thought, what a beautiful picture. She wasn't doing it as a technique. She wasn't doing it, this is my way of winning people. It was just because the lady was a bit deaf. Now, this student was a genius and was going on to become a consultant and everything. And I just thought, no, we really do have to care for people. You can tell it. You know, I've met famous Christian preachers, and to be honest, I've gone, Lord, they're in the kingdom, and can you do something before they get to heaven? Because I'm not going to enjoy heaven with them there. You know, which, and they probably think the same thing. But then I've met people like, you know, Eric Alexander, who, you know, or Sinclair Ferguson, who's with me just now. You know what I love about Sinclair? He's a fantastic preacher. But what I love about Sinclair more than anything else is every time I go in the pulpit, he comes up to me before I go, takes my glasses off and cleans them, because they're always dirty. And that's the equivalent of foot washing. You know, there's a compassion. So I would say we deal with sticky sentimentality by showing the compassion and love of Christ. Mm-hmm. And that should be everyone. Someone tells you a dreadful story, like a woman comes in and tells me how she's been raped and abused and everything like that. If you can't weep at that, I just think there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. You know? So you don't put it on, it's got to be for real. So just real sentiment is how I would say you deal with sticky sentimentality. Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to ask anything or make a comment? Okay. Oh, there's two gentlemen at the back there. You can get them together. And we'll finish with these.
I was interested in what you mentioned about cafe evangelism. Could you just tell us a little bit more about what that looks like, what the logistics of that are?
Okay.
How you've done that.
Yeah, when I wrote the Dawkins letters, I just thought, you know, this is a daft idea to do it in a Christian bookshop. Why don't I go down to Borders and they had a Costa Coffee or something and see if I can launch it there? Now, I heard afterwards they had a big argument about whether they should allow it, but they had a meeting of the staff, and by a casting vote of the manager, they decided to allow it. 100 people turned up, lots of non-Christians. Standing there with a microphone, there was a massive store, and for some reason they put it through the whole PA, so everyone shopping in Borders got to hear the gospel that night. And people were coming up and asking questions and having a go. And I'm standing there thinking, Lord, this is brilliant. I used to do this when I was in student politics. I went home and I remember praying, Lord, how come I haven't done this in 25 years? And the answer I got in my own head anyway was, because you would have been an arrogant so-and-so. Now you've had 25 years of burying kids, dealing with your own failings, doing, you know, and it's just, and all the reading and knowledge and all that kind of stuff. And so I started doing a lot of this. I'd say to churches, say, can you come and do an outreach? And I'd say, yeah, if you do it in a cafe. And they didn't know what to do. They wanted to pack it with Christians. I said, no, I'm not interested in that. Just get people sitting around a table and so on. And actually, if you go to the Solas website, we published our own book called Quench. What we did was, the basic principle was good publicity, good prayer beforehand, good venue, good coffee, you know, and cake. You know, a speaker for 20 minutes, followed by an hour of questions, and great follow-up. That was the kind of principle we operated on. I've done it all over the place. I mean, I'll give you just one example. In Borders in Birmingham, I went, and the manager didn't want us there, and she says, you're not coming. Well, or you are coming, but you're going down to the basement. And she put out about 10 chairs, and I said, no, you're going to need more than that. She looked at me, and she said, David, we had Lawrence Dellagelo, England rugby captain, here last week, 50 people. We had Nigella, our best-selling author, 50 people. Now we got, what we got? You, I said, yeah, okay, let me finish the sentence. Scottish Presbyterian pleb, who's, you know. I said, but there's 3 churches organized this. You're going to need 40 chairs. Anyway, 150 people later, she called in security. And afterwards, she said this to me. She said, it was just great. She said, do you know this? I couldn't believe that. And then I thought it was rent a mob from the church. And I said, yes, it was. 50% of the people there were from the church. Yes, she said, but 50% weren't. And they came because of the subject. And she said, I so loved that. She says, you know what I'm going to do for our Christmas special here in the biggest Borders in Birmingham? I'm going to take Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion and your Dawkins letters, and I'm going to bundle them together as a special. I know. And then she said, you need to go to Cambridge. I'm going to phone our Cambridge manager and tell him to have you. This is not a word of a lie. I got home that night, and before she'd done it, there were 2 invitations from students in Cambridge saying, can you come to Cambridge? You know, so God works, you know. So I'm just saying, there are lots of opportunities. Cafes work really well because you can do it small. And it's not, I mean, I've done it to 15 people and it's been fine. Did it in somewhere in Essex somewhere, and there was 200 people, you know, which is great too, because they could just take it. So good. Guys, I do think our time is gone.